we end up becoming criminals for fishing for food.
The state looks at why Chinook salmon are disappearing. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, October 22nd. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, an unusual school curriculum that's boosting attendance and test scores in a rural village.
We went blueberry and blackberry picking, and we picked ayuk tea, which is tundra tea.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Breastfeeding leads to healthy babies and healthier mothers. Women who breastfeed are less likely to get breast or ovarian cancer, and babies get fewer ear infections, score higher on IQ tests, and are less likely to be obese as adults. The road to lifelong health begins with breastfeeding. Call 907-465-3100 if you have questions about breastfeeding. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services WIC program, an equal opportunity employer.
State fish and game officials are attempting to fill in some blanks in knowledge about Chinook salmon. Poor returns all over Alaska this year have sparked questions about the abundance and reproductive success rate of Alaska's Chinook. Fish and Game has released a draft analysis called Alaska Chinook Salmon Knowledge Gaps and Needs to the public. And today in Anchorage, the department opens its Chinook Salmon Symposium to get some questions answered. But there seem to be few answers and a lot of questions. A panel of scientists opened the symposium this morning with a discussion of what is known about Chinook, their distribution, productivity trends, and the challenges to managers of the resource. But a question and answer session later on revealed what we don't know about the fish. Bob Clark is a fisheries scientist with the state.
We're seeing really cold water temperatures in the Bering Sea after a series of really warm water temperatures, too. We're wondering, as you are wondering, we don't really have the data to know that it's even the ocean. We can point there, and the signs are good that it's probably something in the ocean. But we're getting a lot of these freshwater questions, and those are important, too.
Few Alaska natives were present in the packed room at Anchorage's Egan Center, but Myron Nanning, who heads the Association of Village Council Presidents, says the state needs to have better Alaska Native representation in fisheries management.
We have not had a fair dealing from the state system that's supposedly managing our fishery resources. We end up becoming criminals for fishing for food. And if the state of Alaska and the feds are going to manage this resource to the point of making criminals of our people, it's not fair. We know that there's conservation concerns, but you got to work with people at the local level, at the local villages, and talk to each and every one of them to make sure that they don't end up being criminals like they did this summer.
Fred Huntington from Galena is a lifelong Yukon River fisherman. He says Chinook have declined there for two decades. While Yukon River fishermen get cut off from harvesting due to state in-season management decisions, he says Bering Sea commercial fishermen live under a different set of regulations.
Most of the folks at home that does fish is, why don't they do that with the pollock fisheries too? You know, the pollock fisheries that in 07 stated they had 122,000 Chinook bycatch caught. Those are bound for the western rivers of Alaska. We need to have better ways to negotiate agreement with North Pacific management. The overall picture is the salmon species on the river system is declining so fast that there will be no fish to fight over.
Chinook salmon that spawn in different areas of the state have different migratory patterns, and there are hundreds of individual Chinook salmon stocks. In its draft analysis, Fish and Game calls for a research plan that will identify 12 indicator stocks from the state's major river systems and recommend a stock assessment program for each of the 12. State Legislator Paul Seaton from Homer says Cook Inlet fishermen were also hit hard this summer. Seaton said the state can support research, but it's really up to Fish and Game to find the solution.
But we're trying to make sure that we make data available, make the research available, but not take over the process, because the legislature is really not where we want to be making fish and game decisions. We want those to be very deliberatively done and not your fish versus my fish and that kind of a thing. But we really need the Board of Fishery to be acting in a professional manner of looking at the full research and what we can do for all citizens of Alaska.
Fish and Game expects to be able to release its research plan to the public in December. The Chinook Salmon Symposium continues through Tuesday. A trade group for liquefied natural gas is launching what it calls a major campaign to promote LNG exports. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the initiative aims to sway public support behind exporting LNG, something Alaska has done for decades, but the rest of the country is just beginning.
The government green light for exporting LNG comes from the executive branch. The Obama administration okayed exports out of a Cheniere-owned terminal in Louisiana last April, but has not approved any since. There's a moratorium on approving export terminals until the White House has time to review an outside study about how exports would affect the domestic market. That study, reportedly due out by the end of the year, will not address Alaska's export potential. The state already has approval to export gas from Cook Inlet. Ed Hirse is an energy economist at the University of Houston. He says exporting LNG would have little, if any, effect on consumers in the states.
Everyday consumers are basically getting as much natural gas as they want. Prices are down significantly from 2008, where the average price was about $8 at MCF, to this year, where prices have been around $3.
The Center for Liquefied Natural Gas hopes to spread that word, that because of a huge surplus, exports won't negatively affect the U.S. market. The Trade Association is launching a new campaign today, simply called the LNG Export Initiative. Bill Cooper heads the group. He says the timing, 2 weeks before the election, is purely coincidental. So why now?
Because we got it finished. I know that sounds terrible, but we've been working on this initiative all summer long, and to do the research out in the field and then to process the raw data and develop the website and the talking points and the messaging and all of that took a long time.
The campaign starts with the website and could evolve into commercials, trying to sway both the general public and the people who represent them in Congress. Cooper's hoping that a show of public support for exports could speed up the backlog of pending applications. He says that even though the permitting process goes through both the Department of Energy and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, it's important that Congress knows the potential value of LNG exports.
Well, it's always important to make sure that those with oversight authority over any federal agency is up to speed and aware of the information that's out there that can inform them on either future decisions or indecisions.
One lawmaker who says the U.S. needs to slow down on exporting LNG is Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden. Regardless of what happens this election, Wyden will likely be the top Democrat on the Senate Energy Committee. At a July committee hearing, he warned that exports could increase the volatility in the natural gas market.
If you think guessing on the future of natural gas prices was a challenge before, add the international competition from companies that are already paying four or five times as much and see if the road to stability and predictable natural gas prices smooths out.
On his recent swing through the state, Wyden indicated he's okay with Alaska exporting its LNG, just not the rest of the country. While that's good news for his committee counterpart, Senator Lisa Murkowski, it's going to be a tough sell to other senators from gas-rich states. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Barrow resident remembers the abandoned walrus pups rescued there earlier this year.
That walrus just looked as comfortable as could be, all curled up with her, and she had a bottle and was feeding him, and he didn't look stressed at all.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects, on the web at grantstation.com. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. October is Energy Awareness Month, and the Alaska Energy Authority, along with its partners, say the average homeowner saves $1,200 annually after an energy audit. Learn how to be energy smart. Visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
A national group is asking that the suspensions of two prosecutors in the bungled corruption case of then U.S. Senator Ted Stevens' case be lifted. The National Association of Assistant United States Attorneys says singling out Joseph Bottini and James Gecky for discipline, quote, failed to appropriately acknowledge the collective responsibility of the trial team and the exceptional circumstances that led to the prosecution's discovery-related errors. The group last week filed its brief with the Merit Systems Protection Board, an independent panel that hears appeals. A Justice Department report earlier this year found that Bottini and Gecky had failed to disclose to Stevens' lawyers information that was favorable to the Stevens, but the department's internal ethics watchdog found this was not intentional. Bottini was ordered suspended for 40 days and Gecky for 15. Alaska Public Offices Commission staff says that Alaska State Senate candidate Bob Bell violated campaign finance reporting law, but they are recommending that the fine against Bell be waived. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Bob Bell is running as a Republican candidate in Anchorage's Senate District J against incumbent Democratic candidate Hollis French. Bell has been under investigation by APOC because he did not disclose information he should have about clients and how much they paid an engineering firm in which he holds a controlling interest, according to APOC standards. Bell explains his side of the story during an interview with KAKM.
I didn't drag my feet to disclose my clients. When we called APOC, when I filed, they said I didn't need to give them the list because I didn't own the company anymore. So we didn't. They called us back in and said, the rules changed, so now you do, and we immediately gave them the list.
Bell says he thinks the APOC staff's recommendation was fair. In August, Edward Cullinane filed a complaint with APOC detailing several instances of misreported or unreported personal finances in Bell's financial disclosure statement. Two of the allegations involve the engineering firm F.R. Bell & Associates. Bell started the engineering firm in 1974, but sold the company to a trust in 2007, maintaining the positions of CEO, president, treasurer, and director. The regulation that the commission says Bell is in violation of went into effect in December of 2011. It requires those filing for political office to disclose information about all sources of income over $1,000. One of the clients Bell did not originally disclose was British Petroleum, which paid his company more than $1 million in 2011. Bell should have submitted the information about BP along with the firm's other clients when he filed for candidacy, but he did not. Paul Dauphiné is the executive director of APOC. He says APOC staff recommended waiving the fine for a number of reasons.
One, the regulation has only recently been put in effect, and recently means less than a year in this case. In the past, the commission has waived fines for those people who were subject to a new law or regulation. Mr. Bell was very cooperative. Whenever we asked him for something, for records to review, he was very forthcoming. He responded to us promptly, brought things into our office for us to review.
The commission is expected to make a decision Tuesday. There were a total of three allegations against Bell. APOC staff recommended Bell be found in violation for one of them. The total maximum recommended fine for the violation is $780. Staff costs total around $500. The total potential cost to Bell could be just over $1,000. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
On November 6th, Alaskans will vote on a bond proposition that would allow the state to borrow close to $500 million for transportation-related projects around the state. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The bond package was originally proposed by Governor Sean Parnell's administration, but the legislature ultimately crafted the package of 36 projects. Representative Bill Stoltz, a Republican from the Mat-Su Valley, did much of the work as co-chair of the House Finance Committee. He says bond propositions are a democratic way to get infrastructure projects built.
Each time it's a different set of arguments to the electorate, and that's the beauty of the process. The voters have to embrace that as a good public policy idea. They have to embrace it as an appropriate expenditure and coming from the appropriate funding source. In this case, bond and indebtedness.
The bond proposition would fund port and harbor projects in Bristol Bay, Emonic, Haines, and other communities. Road construction projects would go forward in several places, including Anchorage, the Matsu Valley, and Sitka. Two of the most expensive items on the list are also the most controversial. $50 million would go to the Port of Anchorage expansion and $30 million to the Port Mackenzie rail extension. Bob Shavelson is with the advocacy group Cook Inlet Keeper. He says the ongoing Port of Anchorage project has been fraught with problems from the beginning and calls the rail extension a boondoggle.
Really, the bond measure is a poison pill, and it's forcing Alaskans to swallow spending tens of millions of dollars on these dubious projects, all in the interest of getting some more worthy work done around the state.
The state points out that it's a good time to borrow money for big projects. Alaska's debt manager guesses the state can borrow the money at an interest rate of less than 3%. The total amount of the bond package is about $453 million. Historically, voters in the state have usually approved transportation bond packages. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The Kinnick Arm Bridge will create 1,500 jobs during the 4 years of construction and spur thousands more after completion by creating access to affordable land for commercial, industrial, and residential use. For facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
From a distance, it can be hard to tell why some rural school districts seem to work better than others, why some have better test scores, higher attendance, and graduation rates. In the next installment of our series, Being Young in Rural Alaska, from the producers of Kids These Days, Jessica Cochran looks at one Yukon River village and how the community works together to support the school.
At the St. Mary's School, an entire building is dedicated to Yupik language and skills. Inside, half the space is a large shop area where instructor Nick Thompson is working with students on eel sticks, long pieces of wood carved so the edges are smooth, with rows of sharpened nails running down each side.
The nails, they're on their nail part. This is extra Kirkland.
So what are the eel sticks used for?
Catching eels.
He slowly swishes the stick as if in water.
Back and forth. When you feel them, you pull them out.
One student is mending a fishing net, and others are making harpoons. The students will use these tools they have made on a series of trips, organized by the school each fall. They call them relevant education trips. Relevant because people in St. Mary's live subsistence. They hunt fish and gather much of their food. So the skills they practice on these trips, they use with their families, too. Every student, from kindergarten through 12th grade, has the chance to go on at least one trip each year. Sixth grader Megan Westall.
We went blueberry and blackberry picking, and we picked ayuk tea, which is tundra tea, and we learned how to pick them from my classmate Simone's mom.
These aren't just field trips. Students have data to collect and assignments to do in the field. A math problem involved using distances and geometry to calculate how high a tree is. Science students collect different kinds of leaves and describe the terrain where they found them. There are daily writing assignments. When students return, they complete projects with the data, displaying them on posters that line the school walls. Younger students go on day trips. High school students might go on a four-day trip to the coast or a big fall moose hunting trip. Most anyone in the school can tell you the three requirements to participate: good grades, good attendance, good behavior. Junior Wassily Tinker didn't make the cut his ninth grade year, but it motivated him to do better in school. He did his first moose hunting trip as a sophomore. It was the first time he'd been so far upriver.
Paimutslu, beautiful country. More trees, a lot of thorns. It's hard work when you get a moose in the meadow and there's thorns all over.
Back at school, the students butchered the moose. Some is kept at school, and much is given to the community. It's a back and forth. The community supports the school, too. Yupik teacher Lillian Johnson explains that in the fall, residents host a potlatch for local students.
It had started 26 or 7 years ago, and a lot of our local families couldn't afford to get supplies for the children, for their kids, so the mini potlatch became where it, everybody supported everybody else.
Members of the community are also essential in making the relevant education trips happen. They are the experienced boat captains who can navigate the rivers, the ones who know where to go to find berries. The program began 9 years ago after Dave Herbert became superintendent.
Relevant instruction program has really, I think, built a sense of pride in the school that has been there for many, many years, but it's just kind of rekindled and reinstilled that pride in the community.
Before then, achievement had taken a dip. Morale was low. Lots of students were leaving to go to Mount Edgecombe. Now, suspensions are down. Attendance rates are up. The trips give new teachers the chance to bond with their students and engage with the community early on. But Herbert says the main focus is still on academic standards.
You know, we're teaching the state of Alaska standards in all of our classrooms. That's not negotiable. You know, our school board has never tried to come up with excuses for not meeting AYP. They've always said, we are going to be proactive, and we're not going to come up with excuses. Our kids have the ability and will perform.
But the school's not perfect.
I know the school has a really good reputation of being pushed into education, but there's also a downside to everything. And I just like people to know that.
Student body president John Afkan says there is still peer pressure against being too studious, still a lot of troubles with alcohol and drugs. Test scores have taken a dip the last 2 years. There are still behavior issues and suspensions. But Afkan thinks it's improving, that the relevant instruction trips help. Most of last year's graduates are now in college, and future graduates already have some big plans, like junior Aga Thompson.
I'm thinking about going Fairbanks for 1 year and then go to Dartmouth and become a politician.
And that's what the school board wants, for students to graduate with ideas for the future, options and choices. Reporting from St. Mary's, I'm Jessica Cochran.
For more on the Being Young in Rural Alaska series, head to alaskapublic.org. You may recall stories recently about two Alaska walrus pups going to new homes in big city zoos. The pudgy, cute faces of Puktuk and Mituk were seen nationwide as the youngsters made their way to Indianapolis and New York City zoos. National reports indicated they were rescued from the ocean off Alaska, but that's a pretty big place. KTOO's Rosemarie Alexander narrowed it down with the help of a former Juneau resident who lives in Barrow and visited with one of the walrus pups.
Barrow veterinarian Sarah Coburn is also accompanist for the Presbyterian Church Choir. On Sunday, July 22nd, she told the story of a young walrus being found hanging around a fisherman's net near town. The little guy was at the vet clinic.
So Kathy and I jumped in the car and ran over. They were basically packing him up, getting ready to stick him on one of the air cargo planes to send him down to Seward.
That's former Juneau resident Peter Andreg. He and his wife Kathy have lived in Barrow for 3 years now. When the stories of the two walrus pups hit the news last week, Andreg sent me a picture.
All of a sudden, man, it's just like hit the news, and I'm seeing it everywhere.
And all these articles just kept saying, rescued from the ocean of Alaska.
I know. I thought, come on, that's why I emailed you. I thought, well, you know, you should get some credit here.
Puttick was one of three walruses to be rescued from Barrow area beaches over a two-week period in late June and early July. Dr. Robert Sudam is a wildlife biologist for the North Slope Borough.
3 or 4 days, 5 days before the pups were found, there was a group of at least 1,000 walruses that drifted by on some ice, you know, less than a mile offshore on the Chukchi seaside. And so it seems very likely that somehow the pups got separated from their mom.
One walrus pup was quite sick and died within a week, despite intensive veterinary care at Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward. Sudam rescued the first pup, who was given an Inupiaq Eskimo name.
Puktuk means to get into things, to mess around with things. And since he was there hanging around the fishnet, and in fact the first time the fisherman saw him, the walrus pup was pulling on the net. So he was puktuking with the net.
He says the pup was in pretty good condition, but getting more lethargic by the day. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has management responsibility for stranded marine mammals, That's where biologist Joel Garlick Miller entered the picture.
The calves are very dependent on their mother for a period of 2 years, so they can't really survive on their own if they're abandoned during that critical time. So if we hear of reports of an orphan animal, we try to assess the situation, give them an opportunity to rejoin a herd if possible. And if that doesn't seem likely after a period of about 48 hours, then we consider capturing the animal for rehabilitation.
That was the case for both Puttick and Mittick. Dr. Sudam captured Puttick with a large round hoop net that he uses for beluga whales when attaching satellite trackers.
So I basically snuck up on one side of him. My wife, Leslie Pierce, was on the other side of him, distracting him, and I walked right up to him and put this hoop net over him, and then we picked him up with a lot of effort and wrestled him into the back of the SUV.
Sudam says he initially thought the walrus pup was about 70 pounds, but he turned out to be 250. Puttick stayed in the SUV. That's where the Andrig saw him.
What was really amusing is one of the stories I saw in the media talked about how they were so cuddly. And it seems a little funny because they're, a couple hundred pounds of cuddly. But sure enough, the one that we saw, one of Sarah's assistants, was in the cage with this walrus. And that walrus just looked as comfortable as could be, all curled up with her. And she had a bottle and was feeding him. And he didn't look stressed at all.
Puttick and Mittick spent the rest of the summer at the Sea Life Center until the right homes could be found at aquariums that already have walrus. U.S. Fish and Wildlife's Garlick Miller saw them both as they headed out of Alaska, Puttick to Indianapolis Zoo and Mittick to the New York Aquarium in Brooklyn. He says they'll serve as good ambassadors for Alaska's wildlife and educate zoo visitors about the growing problem of the loss of summer sea ice in the Arctic.
Walrus in Alaska used to spend all their summer months out in floating sea ice habitats, but in recent years, the sea ice has moved beyond the shallow continental shelf waters where walrus feed, and so they've been forced ashore along the coast.
There's now a proliferation of walrus haulouts on the Arctic coast with thousands of animals at a time. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org or follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Jessica Cochran in St. Mary's, and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Locke.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Bioneers in Alaska, presenting practical sustainability strategies for Alaskans at its 9th annual conference, October 26th through the 28th at UAA. Bioneersinalaska.org. The Kinnick Arm Bridge will create 1,500 jobs during the 4 years of construction and spur thousands more after completion by creating access to affordable land for commercial, industrial, and residential use. For facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. If you're curious about the rich marine and terrestrial life of the North Pacific and are looking for an educational adventure, then come to the Sitka Whale Fest on November 1st through the 4th. Hear from prominent scientists, enjoy a 5 and 10K run, and a variety of fun community events and whale-watching cruises. Early registration and discount information at sitkawhalefest.org. WhaleFest is a program of the Sitka Sound Science Center. This message sponsored by the Sitka Whale Fest.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.